And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and we are very, very happy to welcome back to our studios for her monthly visit to the program, Nan Calvert, who helps put together once a month a program of environmental interest under the auspices of the United Environmental Council. And something very fun and exciting is going to be happening today as we have a very special guest joining us via Skype to talk about a wonderful organization called Living Lands and Waters. And so first of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you to the morning show. Welcome you back.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Gregory.
Good to have you here. And we'll introduce our special guest who's joining us via Skype in just a second. Nan, tell us first of all how you encountered Kate for the first time.
This is my first encounter with Kate, actually. But with Living Lands and Waters, I was trying to remember exactly how I came to know about them. But what I can say is that a number of years ago, one of the conservation subdivisions for the Kenosha Racine Land Trust benefited greatly from their 1 Million Trees project. And we planted hundreds and hundreds of native oak whips. And ever since then, I've been a big fan of Living Lands and Waters. And Kate will tell you all about Living Lands and Waters, but it's about the connection to our rivers, particularly for them, the Mississippi River, river cleanups, but also working with communities to get them to connect to their local watersheds and realize how things on land affect the rivers and vice versa. So I think many of our listeners have probably received an oak whip or two at various and sundry Earth Day celebrations and other places as well. So I just thought it was really important to have them on and get the name out there.
Well, terrific. Well, those of you listening don't know, but I'm looking right at the face of Kate because she's joining us via Skype from East Moline, Illinois, where Living Lands and Waters is based. And Kate, I was so excited to make the Skype connection, I forgot to ask you how we pronounce your last name.
It's Runge.
It's what's that?
Runge.
Runge. Kate, yes. Runge. And you are the, I believe, the communications director and special events coordinator for the organization. How long have you been with them?
I have been with them. It'll be a little about over 2 years. This January it was, so.
Tell us a little bit about yourself ahead of that. Are you from the Midwest originally, and maybe did you grow up near or close to the Mississippi River, or is your connection to this project due to something else?
Yeah, I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in Andalusia, Illinois, which is right outside of the Quad Cities where we're based, probably less than a mile away from the river. So I grew up boating right next to the Mississippi on the beaches all the time. I actually went to school for marketing and media, and then worked in health insurance for 3 years, so that was a fun little break. But I saw a Facebook post about the marketing job, and I had heard about Chad my entire life, so I jumped on it and took a chance, and here I am.
Wow. I should mention, before I forget, that I had the opportunity to interview Chad some years ago when his book was first published, called From the Bottom Up. Uh-huh. And so I actually have known about your organization and his work for quite some time. For our listeners who don't know so much about Living Lands and Waters, sketch just what the scope of your projects are. What does your organization try to do?
So we're a nonprofit river cleanup organization. So the main focus is river cleanups, obviously. We do community cleanups all down 23 rivers that we've been on so far. So the Mississippi, the Ohio, the Tennessee, you name it, we've probably been there. We also do educational workshops. We think that keeping the river clean is one thing, but or cleaning it up is one thing, but keeping it clean is another. So we host high school students from all across the United States onto our barge. To date, I think we've hosted over 7,000 in our floating classroom. So education is a big deal for us. We also do our Million Trees project. So we'll actually give away our million tree this spring from our own tree nursery. We do invasive species removal. And I think that's about it.
I think that's I was going to say that's enough. I suppose it's never enough, but it's plenty what all of you do. And Nan, you were saying you've had some connection with this organization, really admired their work for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you can get people involved at the grassroots level, planting trees and getting them to understand how that impacts not only the land but the water, you begin to build a very, very good connection and a very good understanding about how people can be very effective earth stewards in a very simple way.
So tell us a little more about this. We'll spend plenty of time talking about the river cleanup, which, of course, is kind of the heart and soul and bedrock of what your organization is about. But let's talk about this Million Trees project, because the connection between that and cleaning up a river does not seem quite so clear. Do you have anything? Are you able to tell us sort of how that sort of sprouted up in the midst of this other main mission of your organization?
Absolutely. So the Million Trees Project was founded in 2007, and we kind of wanted to further our mission. Obviously, keeping the trash off the banks is one thing, but planting trees actually enhances the watershed along the rivers. It increases biodiversity, it improves water quality and the air quality, it helps reduce erosion, and a big part of it is we only plant oak trees, so they all are nut-bearing, so they all provide food for the native species.
Can you explain a little more of the science of that, Nan, about what kind of difference these trees would make in terms of the health of a river?
Well, a big difference is erosion control. Most of us understand that siltification of our waterways has been a big problem for a very, very long time. And when you can revegetate a stream bank or a river bank, particularly with roots that go long and deep, you get to hold on to those banks for a very, very long time. And then, of course, if you have good understory and good ground cover, you're even better off. So preventing and controlling erosion is a big deal, whether it's for a big river like the Mississippi River or a smaller river like the Root River or the Pike River. It's something that we can all do. And then, of course, on our own properties, it helps when you plant trees there's a lot of runoff in our urban and suburban and certainly our rural areas as well because of different kinds of land practices. So getting trees in there, especially native vegetation, goes a long way toward keeping the waters clean. And the tree roots do help filter out a few other things as well.
Wow. So a million trees is a lot of trees. Explain to our listeners, Kate, how these million trees have sort of come into being. It sounds like there have been a couple of really neat strategies that your organization has adopted.
So we did have another tree nursery down in, it was in Beardstown, Illinois. That was too far away for a location for us, so it was super hard to maintain. As you can imagine, there's a lot of weed pulling involved in maintaining a tree nursery. And then for a while, we actually purchased our trees from a nursery in St. Louis, but for the last 2 years, we have been growing our own trees from a brand new tree nursery we broke ground on in 2014. So our millionth tree will actually be harvested from our own nursery, which is really exciting.
Nan was mentioning something about school children being involved, at least to some extent, in this undertaking. Is that right?
In terms of the
gathering of acorns.
Oh, well, so I'm not sure if they gathered acorns in the past. So that they could have been. They're involved in a lot of our tree plantings and our maintenance events.
Ah.
So they help us kind of keep the nursery in tip-top shape.
Wow.
And plant the acorns. So it's just a full circle process.
Terrific. So, Nan, explain how on the kind of the local level you became aware of this Million Tree Project with one of the conservancies in the area.
Well, Kenosha Racine Land Trust guides and assists one of the conservation subdivisions in Caledonia. And there was a lot of invasive species removal done there, and it left a wide open area. And, of course, everybody knows that nature abhors a vacuum. So when you take something out, it paves the way for something else to come in. And, of course, what happens most of the time is that non-native species, invasive species, set up shop really quickly. That's how they begin to take over everything. They don't have any natural checks and balances. So when you clear an area and then you begin to revegetate with native vegetation, you can restore an area in a very effective way. Trees are very expensive to purchase, particularly if they're of a size.
Mm.
But when you plant a tree, regardless of its age at the time of planting, whether it's a more mature tree that's very large and has to be put in by a spade, or something smaller that you can hand dig and plant, you're planting for the future. You're making a legacy. You're not necessarily doing it for now. So one of our residents in this particular subdivision by the name of Larry Strickland got a bunch of trees. He organized the neighborhood what would be the neighborhood association, and they planted hundreds and hundreds of oak whips from Living Lands and Waters at least a couple of years in a row, and there was a very high success rate. One thing you have to know about oak trees, particularly when they're babies, is that they need consistent moisture. They don't do well drying out. They don't do well in droughty times. So you do have to be a good steward, a good caretaker, or a parent, if you will, for these little trees. But we had really good success rate, and they're tall now. They're teenage trees.
Wow, very good. So, Kate, who ends up with these oak trees? I mean, and how far and wide have they, in a sense, been spread?
I think, well, so a lot of them end up locally. They go to anyone in the community who wants them. A lot of schools get them, a lot of park districts. I think we've had some trees go to Oregon. Obviously, we give away oak trees, so we try not to give them away in places that they're not going to grow and thrive. So that's a big part of deciding who gets them and where they go. We want to give them the best chance they possibly have to survive.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking on the morning show today, not only with Nan Calvert, who joins us each and every month with the United Environmental Council, but also joining us via Skype, Kate Runge, who is the Director of Marketing and Special Events Coordinator for an organization based in East Moline, Illinois, called Living Lands and Waters. And this was created some years ago by a young man who was anxious to spearhead an aggressive cleanup effort for the Mississippi River. And he wrote a book called From the Bottom Up. Chad Pagracki, is that his
name?
Yeah,
Pagracki.
Yeah, it was his name. And I had the pleasure of doing a phone interview with him for the morning show. I'm sure that's 7, 8, 9 years ago by now. But it was so fun to sort of catch his spirit of great enthusiasm. And, of course, this organization he helped create, Living Lands and Waters, is still in existence and doing tremendously important work on behalf of the Mississippi River. And beyond that, helping a lot of people come to better understand the importance of our rivers remaining healthy. So, Kate, let's talk a little bit about this facet of what Living Lands and Waters does. First of all, can you give us some kind of sense of when this organization was created and sort of the state of affairs in the Mississippi River, which necessitated a special organization being created? I mean, just how dirty was the Mississippi at that point?
So Living Lands and Waters, we were founded in 1998. But before that, Chad, our founder and president, actually worked right along the rivers as a commercial shell diver for the cultured pearl industry. And he was also a commercial fisherman. So he spent a lot of his time actually camping out on the islands as he went down. So it was during that time that he just started to see how crazy it was. And Chad was only... he was about 17 at the time. So if you can imagine, a 17-year-old can tell that the rivers are too dirty. They were pretty dirty. So he started making calls to government agencies and saying, like, hey, these rivers are trash. And everybody was basically like, who are you? And what garbage are you talking about? So in 1997, he started out on his own in his own boat, picking up the garbage just one piece at a time. And another cool story people might not know is actually Chad's parents were away, and he had to put this garbage somewhere, so he turned their backyard into a recycling center. So by the time they came home, their backyard was completely packed full of tires and barrels and anything you can imagine.
Hmm. I remember from our conversation talking about his book that we're not just talking about a little too much litter. I mean, we're talking about tires and refrigerators and safes and all kinds of huge objects that had just been dumped into the Mississippi River without any thought whatsoever about the damage that was being done. And, of course, if all you ever do is drive alongside the Mississippi River or drive over the bridge and look down at these this lovely looking river, you have no idea that beneath that pristine surface is all this garbage. I mean, it's hard to imagine that so much garbage could be, in a sense, right under our noses, and yet we'd be so oblivious to it, especially if the people, too many of the people working the river, don't happen to care about that. But he did, of course.
Yeah.
So tell us what the focus of the organization is in terms of trying to effectively clean up the Mississippi. I guess that was the first thing, is that this terrible mess needed to be addressed. What are the ways then and now that the actual cleanup has occurred?
Sorry, will you say that one more time?
So tell us about how the cleanup sort of first began as this organization was created, and then we'll talk about how what you're doing to try to maintain its more pristine state.
So Chad started out in a boat by himself doing cleanups. Eventually he gathered a little crew, and then they lived in a houseboat and floated down the river. And it was during that time that they were visiting the cities and piling the garbage onto the boat that the community started to take notice. So slowly but surely, the community started to want to get involved. They were like, where did you find all those tires? The visuals really helped with that. So it's kind of become a community-wide effort as we go down. Community cleanups are one of our biggest focuses. We're totally volunteer-based. We've worked with over 94,000 volunteers to help us clean up 8.6 million pounds of trash now.
Wow. Your organization is based in East Moline. How much of the Mississippi do you, in a sense, try to take care of? I mean, how far north, how far south of the length of the Mississippi?
So we've been really blessed in the last probably 4 or 5 years. From St. Louis all the way up to St. Paul is actually pretty clean. We've made a difference since we've started. So we have a program called the Great Mississippi River Cleanup. It's our way of supporting cleanups from the back end, and they allow us to, you know, keep our efforts sustainable and visit other areas more in need. So we actually have groups, community groups, all up the Mississippi to St. Paul that hold their own cleanups. We send them garbage bags, gloves, and T-shirts for their volunteers and kind of guidance to set up the cleanups. So they basically maintain the northern stretch of the Mississippi for us, really. And that has allowed us to go to, in the past year, we went out to the Tennessee River and the Ohio River, but the Ohio River will be one of our bigger focuses for the next few years.
Wow. So in other words, your organization isn't the only one directly cleaning the river, but you are doing all that you can to help spark the effort of other groups to do what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we are the only industrial strength. So we're the only river cleanup organization with 5 barges. We actually just in the last year got a John Deere excavator donated to us and a mini tugboat. So we're actually hoping to do 1 million pounds in the next season.
Wow. So when you actually go out with one of your barges, typically what happens? I mean, what are kind of the nuts and bolts of a typical cleanup expedition that your organization might be involved in?
So our barges, we call it the barge. There's actually 5 barges. That's kind of like our floating headquarters. We live on the barge. We eat. There's a full kitchen, floating classroom, bathroom, washer, dryer. But we have 5 30-foot-long custom aluminum John boats. So we take out these John boats and fill them up with trash, bring them back, and then the barge is actually more like our floating recycling center. So we sort things out by the bags, the tires, the scrap metal. So it's more like a huge visual, but the boats are actually what we would take out to pick up the items.
How does the trash come out of the river? I mean, are you diving down to the bottom of the river, or do you have machinery that just scoops it up? I mean, how is it actually being removed?
We obviously, if there's anything floating, we pick that up as we go. We work a lot on the shorelines, though, because the water will come up and then come down. And we play a lot with the water levels. So when the water's down, we make sure we hit those areas that will, in essence, all be back in the river once the water comes up. So we kind of play a lot with the tides.
I see. So a lot of it ends up being visual, depending on when you're visible, I should say, depending on when you actually do this. And then some of what you bring up then actually can find use in recycling, could potentially even be resold, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we recycle, it's about 80% roughly. All of our tires go to Bridgestone, and they are repurposed for playgrounds and maybe even new tires. Our scrap metal, all we scrap out, and the profits come back to us. And then our bags are the actual fun part. We do a Recycle Like a Rockstar event. So we actually take a crane, take all these bags that we handpicked off of the barge, and then we dump them into troughs and have people hand sort out the recyclables.
Wow.
So it's about 80%. That event is super messy and super awesome.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Do you have to do this cleanup work in coordination with government agencies of any kind? I mean, like, for instance, the Department of Natural Resources or that kind of thing? Or are you completely on your own and, in a sense, free to do whatever it is you see fit in terms of doing this cleanup?
We work a little bit in ties with those sort of agencies, but for the most part, I would say we're on our own. We kind of set our own schedule and head our own direction every year.
Talk about this new direction that you were talking about in terms of branching off into other rivers. I think you mentioned the Tennessee River and the Ohio River. So those are maybe the first two. Can you tell us about what prompted that interest? And was that, in a sense, kind of a dramatic move for your organization to make away from the Mississippi River specifically?
Chad started on the Mississippi, but to date we've worked on 23 rivers in 20 different states. So we have quite a few. A lot of them are littler ones, maybe not as big as the Mississippi. We work a lot on the Illinois up around our area. There's a ton of little ones. The Tennessee River was a big move for us. The Tennessee River, if you've ever seen it, is one of the most beautiful rivers I've ever seen. It's not super dirty, but on that trip, we basically wanted to say it's not super dirty, but it still needs to be kept clean. We could still hold cleanups. It still needs to be maintained. So every river kind of has a different focus. The Ohio River that we're going on has a lot more industrial plants kind of along the river. So the trash you see there is completely different than the trash you see on the Tennessee River. It's huge oil barrels and things that we can't pick up with our hands. So which is why we kind of pushed for our new operations, which is, like I said, our new barge, our new mini tugboat and excavator, which will be broken apart from the rest of the fleet during educational workshops. So we will actually drive one of the barges out and around in this upcoming fall and kind of handpick stuff with our excavator. So that'll be a big change in how we do things coming up.
Wow.
Quick question. Do you do water quality testing?
We do with our educational workshops. Yep, that's always one of our lessons we offer.
And then those results are reported to whom?
You know, I'm actually not sure. I know that we have a big database full of them, but I'm not sure exactly where they end up.
Because, of course, that's another whole issue, isn't it? I mean, besides just the stuff in terms of the things that are in a river that aren't supposed to be there, but also the stuff that the chemicals and so on that get dumped into a river, perhaps, that can cause damage.
Yep, our educational workshops do a lot touching on that aspect of things. Obviously, we focus on the trash, but the education of all what's going on in the river is super important as well.
So how do you, for instance, get to where you want to be in a place like the Tennessee River, which obviously connects to the Mississippi? So are you traveling by water? I mean, are you traveling on the Mississippi until you get to the Tennessee and then heading up it like that?
So the barge itself is actually doing that. To give you an idea of how long it takes, an hour of car travel is about a day on the barge. So it's a lot faster and more efficient. For the crew, we tend to drive on the roads, and then the barge will travel there. So that gives us the opportunity to, A, do more events, B, have time off. There's always probably at least a few crew members that actually travel on the barge through the lock and dams along the river systems, which is always a cool ride. Everybody's done it, but it's just a lot more efficient for us to move some of our equipment on the roads.
Mm. Do you have much sense, Kate, of how serious this problem, specifically with the Mississippi, still is? That is, are people still dumping tires in the Mississippi River and refrigerators and all kinds of other things? I mean, it just sort of seems insane that people would do that. And yet, obviously, it happened for years and years and years with nobody saying much of anything about it. I mean, Do you have a sense that is different now, that less of that kind of thoughtless dumping into the river is occurring now?
I think like the overall awareness has been minimally brought up. People know that you shouldn't drop things, obviously, into the river. It's your drinking water. I think the overall awareness is up, but it's still happening. We go to a lake called McKellar Lake, which is an outlet of the Mississippi River in Memphis. We've been going there we host a program called Alternative Spring Break for college kids. So since 2011, we've gone there, and we probably average 100,000 pounds of trash in 3 weeks every single year. So there's certain areas that are just huge problem areas, and it's not all illegal dumping. In Memphis, the problem is actually their storm drains. They don't have grates on them so that the sticks and rocks can wash down from the city streets. So anything that gets dropped on the streets, it goes down into this this creek called Nankana Creek, and then drops off into the McKellar Lake, and then it'll go right out into the Mississippi. So in this area in particular, you can sit for probably 20 minutes at a time just picking up trash. You don't really have to move. It's a little bit crazy. So there still are problem areas, but Chad and some local groups are working with the local government, and they are installing these trash booms, so it collects the trash on top of the water. So they're installing those, which will be a huge move. We've been there, like I said, for 5 years, but stuff is happening, slowly creeping in towards getting things corrected so that this lake isn't completely trashed.
Wow. You were saying, Kate, that part of the mission of your organization is also the maintaining of sort of a cleaner state once maybe a river has been at least somewhat cleaned up from its original state. So tell us what the most important facets of that part of your mission is.
So I think I've said this about three times, but cleaning up the river is one thing. Keeping it clean is another thing. One of the biggest programs we host is Adopt a River Mile. It's important that everyone does their part. Obviously, if everyone kept the river near them clean, then, I mean, we would have no work to do. So our Adopt a River Mile program has citizens all over the U.S. We just expanded it to all U.S. rivers, taking care of their own stretches, the stretches that matter to them. And I think if everybody kind of stepped up and took a part in it, it would make a huge difference for us. Our organization was started that one man can make a difference, and we totally believe that one person can make a huge difference in the landscape around them. So,
you also mentioned at one point the removal of invasive species, which is one of Nan Calvert's most important causes. So I know she would like us to talk about that at least a little bit. How important is that to your organization, and what sorts of efforts have you undertaken towards that goal of invasive species removal?
Invasive species removal, it's one of our newer programs. I believe it was started in 2014. It kind of, like Nan said, tied hand in hand with our Million Trees project. You don't want to plant these baby trees around all of these invasive species that are going to allow them not to grow. So we started the invasive species removal in Illiniwek Forest Reserve. We kind of wanted to keep it concentrated until we, you know, figured out the nuts and bolts of the program. So we've been working in Illiniwek Forest Reserve in Hampton, Illinois, for the past 2 years. I think we've worked on about 20 acres now to remove honeysuckle is our main focus there. We kind of just started super concentrated with just honeysuckle. So you just chop, lop, and pull. They're some of our funner events. But we plan to expand it and move. We have been just slowly starting to do events elsewhere, but it's kind of just getting to know how the whole process goes, the cutting and the spraying and marking and everything. So it's been kind of a new learning process for us.
Ah, well, Nan is our local expert on invasive species, so there's just not
crazy person.
Well, right, yes, but I mean, but it's such an important thing. Nan, say a word about particularly how the eradication of invasive species can make a real difference when it comes specifically to, for instance, river cleanup, because I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily see that as an important connection.
So, in all of our wet areas, shall we say, whether it's a riparian zone, those areas along rivers and streams in our wetlands, the areas along ponds, there are infestations of reed canary grass and purple loosestrife and all kinds of horrible things. And what happens is, number one, they often form monocultures. So right there, you're shattering the idea of biodiversity. And the key to life on Earth is biodiversity. So you have fewer insects, you have fewer aquatic species happening, and that also includes aquatic plants. So because invasive species can outcompete so easily, since all of their checks and balances have been removed and were left behind wherever they originated, they get a leg up on all of our beautiful native species. So it's really essential to begin to eradicate these. And I know that most people say that 100% eradication is impossible. But then again, there are a lot of things that we thought were impossible at one time that have been that have come to fruition. So I would always hope that people go for 100% eradication and reestablishment of native plant communities. Because once you reestablish native plant communities, you have native bird communities, native insect communities, native mammal communities, and that whole great and grand mosaic starts to come together again. So, you know, people have all of these projects going on where they go in and remove buckthorn and honeysuckle, but they don't replant. And you have to have both going on basically at the same time, if at all possible. And Kate mentioned that they worked on 20 acres. It's really great to set aside a unit, one place where you're concentrating your efforts, removal and replanting, and get that up and running and then move on to another one.
Hmm.
It's hard to watch those areas outside of your zone, but eventually you'll get to those. The problem is that, you know, our municipalities, our local governments, our state governments really don't put any importance on habitat reclamation. They focus on everything else. But if we don't have clean water and we don't have stable soils and we don't have clean air, then what do we have? We have essentially nothing. So
this matter of trees being planted, I think, Kate, you were saying that in terms of this wonderful project with a million trees, but you're going to be planting trees that don't have a chance to thrive if they're planted in a place where there are invasive species. So part of the purpose of this was to make sure these beautiful new trees have a chance to grow, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just wanted to reiterate, too, the fact that they're growing on oak trees is essential because I know that I've said this before, and I don't mind saying it again. Our native oak tree species support well over 500 species of native moths and butterflies. So you're supporting a huge swath of the insect population. Therefore, you're supporting birds, and you're supporting other things that eat insects, and you're also supporting native plants that rely on those insects for pollination. So if you can only do one thing, plant an oak tree somewhere.
Right. Well, and they've planted a million of them. So you used the term whip at one point, Kate. What exactly is an oak tree whip?
Oh, I think that was actually Nan here.
That's
oak tree whip. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's just one of those sort of, it's just a term plant people use to describe a tree that's small. And, if you know what a switch is, or if you've grown up in the South and you had to cut a switch. So it's a very long, thin, twig-like, very young tree. Essentially, it's an infant tree that's only, maybe 2 years old, possibly 3 years old. And you can see the long root and a few of the root hairs coming off of those. And they're transplanted as rootstock. They're perfectly healthy and alive and vigorous. And anybody essentially can plant them. And you put them in the ground and keep them evenly moist. And you get to watch this baby tree grow and grow and grow. And you leave a legacy for the next generation and the next generation and the next generation.
Wow. And Kate, you were saying the millionth tree is soon to be planted. Is that right?
Yeah, we'll actually harvest. I think we harvest either sometime this spring, either late March or early April. We'll be harvesting them and then starts the process of wrapping them and preparing them to go. Some of them will go, like I said, to communities and schools, but some of them will be involved in tree plantings with us. But like Nan said, it's so great to watch a tree grow and thrive. But so part, those trees that we're giving away will be available to the public to request on this week, I think, or next week, February 15th. You can request free oak trees. So if you have a good home for them, you can go to our website.
Wow. Before we let you go, Kate, I don't know that we've really adequately sorted out the size and scope of your organization. I mean, how, first of all, how big a sort of paid staff is there for Living Lands and Waters? And then what sort of an army of volunteers are we talking about?
So there's only 13 of us, which is fun and great. We did about 203 events last year with our staff. So we've worked in total with 94,000 volunteers, and we will actually hit our 100,000th this year, our 100,000 volunteer, which is super exciting for us. Just to give you a scope of our stats, so we've worked on 23 rivers in 20 states, and then 94,000 volunteers to remove 8.6 million pounds of trash. We'll be hosting our 900th cleanup this year as well, which is super exciting. So we have a lot of milestones coming up.
So who pays the bills? Because at least some of what you do has to be a fairly expensive sort of undertaking.
Yeah, we're almost close to running on a budget of $2 million. We're totally run off of donations, though. We have some large corporate sponsors, but a lot of what keeps us going is individual donations.
So if people are interested in supporting what you do, what should they do?
Visit our website. You can learn more about us at livinglandsandwaters.org. And there's more information on all of our programs, how to donate, how you can get involved. Our Facebook page is also a really good way to keep up with current events if you're interested in volunteering.
What's that address again?
Livinglandsandwaters.org.
Very good. Kate Runge is Director of Marketing and Events Coordinator for Living Lands and Waters. Kate, it's been great to meet you and great to hear so much about your great organization. As I said, I had the pleasure of speaking with your founder, Chad, some years ago, and about his really interesting book called From the Bottom Up. And it's great to know that the organization is alive and well and thriving and making such an important difference in the world. We thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show and wish you well.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you here. Bye-bye. So it is fun to be hearing about an organization that is doing such spectacular things. I wonder, Nan, as you listen to kind of the legacy of this organization, what sort of thoughts it sparks in terms of what might happen even beyond what already is happening, for instance, on the local scene.
I think the thing that is moving me is that it started with one person. And look what's happened. It started in 1998, which isn't very long ago, with one person who saw a problem and decided to do something about it. That's truly miraculous. I mean, it's so inspiring. It just means that there's such potential out there in the human community to do good and have far-reaching impact. Look at how many people have volunteered. Look at how many millions of pounds of trash they've taken out of the waterways. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's so wonderful.
What is it about rivers that make them sort of especially important and especially challenging in terms of a project cleanup? I'm thinking about, for instance, the flow of water, the fact that, you know, there's nothing stationary in a sense,
right,
about a river. It's a very dynamic sort of living thing in a sense. But does that make the matter of cleaning it up in the first place and keeping it clean in the second place, does that make it harder?
Sure. The phrase, we all live downstream, comes to mind. So when they go out on their barges and their tugboat to clean things up, that garbage has come from someplace else upstream. So they're doing such great and laudable work in areas all along the river. They're doing so much education and people are getting involved. And hopefully that kind of commitment, that kind of education, that kind of information is also going upstream. As Kate said, they have to work with the tides. So, they have to work with the tide so that when the garbage is there to see, they can go and get it. And it also strikes me that there has to be so much skill to maneuver these boats. I didn't get a chance to ask, but they certainly have actual real boat captains that operate the boats. Mm. And then just the sheer challenge of separating the garbage and getting it to where it needs to go. I mean, there seem to be huge obstacles that they have overcome so easily.
Or at least overcome, maybe not all that.
It seems easy to us sitting here in the station.
Right.
And then, of course, the weather. You know, storms pop up and things happen, and I suppose they occasionally have to abandon an effort. But, wow.
They've done some amazing things.
Absolutely.
I suppose another matter with rivers, which maybe is one reason why an organization like Living Lands and Waters is such a good thing, is that you have particularly a lengthy river like the Mississippi, you're talking about all kinds of different municipalities mm-hmm. that are along its banks, various states, various counties, various cities. And the chances of all of those various municipalities working together for the benefit of the river's overall health, it's not likely that that is going to happen or not happen completely or happen easily. And in a sense, an organization that takes sort of emotional ownership of the river itself could make a huge difference because of that.
Enormous. You know, we're lucky here in Racine and Kenosha and just generally in southeastern Wisconsin because we do have a very strong environmental community. And when you think about Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network and the attention that's been given to the to those rivers and also the involvement of the municipalities and the leaders within the municipalities, you know, you'd always like to have more, but you have to start someplace. In other communities, it's much more difficult. And again, you know, it always comes down to money. Very few communities spend money on environmental concerns, even though those are extremely important. It's your drinking water. I mean, look at the disaster that's happened in Flint, Michigan. Hmm. People weren't, you know, well, we all know what's happened there.
Right.
But when
yeah.
it gets to that point and people are, people's lives are on the line, you think back and, well, maybe we should have done something about that earlier on.
No kidding. So we want to remind everybody again that this organization that we talked about today is called Living Lands and Waters, and they do have a beautiful, fun website, actually, very, very colorful, in which you can learn about their founder and learn about all the various things which they do. And again, we're grateful to Kate Runge for joining us today via Skype to talk more about it. Nan, you have some events you want to tell us about in the closing couple of minutes?
We have some really interesting things going on. In general, World Water Day, this is a really important announcement given what we were talking about and also given what's happening in southeastern Wisconsin with Lake Michigan and other things. Tuesday, March 22nd, 2016 is World Water Day. And you can go to the World Water Day website, but it's all about getting people to be aware of how much water do you use? What do you use it for? What watershed do you live in? Do you know what a watershed is? You know, where does your water come from? So, World Water Day, Tuesday, March 22nd. Earth Hour will be happening on March 19th from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. This actually started in 07 in Australia, Sydney to be exact. And there was a group that wanted to highlight climate change and the factors that contribute to climate change and what we humans can do about it. And on the day that it started, 2.2 million people and 2,000 businesses turned out the lights for an hour to show what an impact we humans can have for good. So Earth Hour, 8:30 to 9:30 p.m., March 19th, turn out your lights.
Hmm.
All right. So the Great Backyard Bird Count is happening Friday, February 12th, which is tomorrow, through Monday, February 15th. This is a worldwide effort, and it happens as a result of a joint collaboration of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, the National Audubon Society, and Bird Studies Canada. And the Backyard Bird Count means that people go out for 15 minutes as many times as they want during that time period, February 12th through the 15th, and they count the birds that come to their bird feeders. And if you know the species, that's great. And then you can go to www.birdcount.org, and you can report your sightings through something called eBird. This is really important. This is citizen science in action. Hmm. You don't even have to do it in your own backyard. You can go to a local park. You could come to Seno Conservancy. You could go to River Bend. You could go to all kinds of places and participate in this bird count. You can also go to Hoy Audubon's page for more information about that. Okay, now, on March 12th at Seno Conservancy from 9 until noon, there's going to be this really great art and nature fusion class. It's called Pine Needle Basketry. There's a wonderful artist coming by the name of Roberta Condon, and she's from the Driftless Folk School up in the Driftless area from Wisconsin. It's both for an beginner and experienced basket weavers. You're going to use pine needles and create really beautiful small baskets. You can go to our website and take a look at what they're going to look like. To register, go to you can call 262-539-3222 or send me an email at nan@sinokrlt.org.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Those are some interesting events for sure. And I know that when you come back to us in March, we're going to be talking about Earth Day and various special events that are going to be going on, including some of what's going on here at Gateway Technical College.
I'll just add one more thing. Last year at Seno Conservancy, we had to take down 4.5 acres of ash trees due to emerald ash borer. We'll be reforesting this spring as soon as things warm up and the soil is warm enough to accept trees. We're going to be planting all kinds of trees, actually, nut-bearing trees, fruit-bearing trees, hardwoods. And people who come out to help us in the form of volunteers will receive their own free trees, courtesy of Living Lands and Waters. You'll get to take home some oak trees for your very own property. So give us a shout. We'll get you on the volunteer list, and we'll plant some trees together.
Fantastic. Nan Calvert, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. My pleasure.
We'll see you in March. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast is for a sunny, very cold day with a high temperature today of 18 degrees. Partly cloudy and very cold overnight. The low will be 8 above. Tomorrow, Friday, partly sunny, much like today, maybe even a little windier, with a high tomorrow of 19 degrees. The really cold day is Saturday. Under sunny skies, a high of just 9 above. Wind chills easily 20 below zero. Not quite so cold, though, on Sunday. Valentine's Day, a 50% chance of light snow and a high of 20, warming to 29 on Monday and into the 30s after that.